Welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast for the first week of February 2010. My name is Elise Hugh, joined by CEO and Editor-in-Chief Evan Smith.
Hi, Elise.
Ben Philpott, who covers the governor's race for the Tribune and KUT News.
Hello.
And Emily Ramshaw, who's sitting in for Ross today and a Tribune reporter. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
Welcome. And since this is your first Tribcast, we're going to let you go first with your topic on Terry Hodge, who is taking off, going to resign from the Texas House.
Sure. Basically, Terry Hodge announced this morning that she was pleading guilty to federal fraud, tax fraud charges. These are these charges that are stemming from this Dallas City Hall corruption investigation. So basically, that means that Eric Johnson, her opponent in the primary, in the Democratic primary, is running unopposed, except that Terry's name will still be on the ballot, which presents some interesting issues there.
I wonder how much this is like or unlike the Kip Averett situation in Waco, where you have a Republican state senator who decided after the filing deadline that he no longer wanted to serve, but he can't get off the ballot. And in that case, the district is rallying to elect him anyway because they don't want the guy who is running against him, the fellow from Burleson. Yancey is
Darren
his name.
Yancey,
Darren
yeah.
Yancey. So the thought is that Averett will win the primary because the Waco voters want to keep that seat in Waco, and then the minute he wins, he says, I'm ineligible to run, and they appoint, local Republicans appoint somebody just to take his place on the ballot. In this case, though, the fact that Hodge is on the ballot, I assume there would be the opposite reaction from the district. They want to defeat her in the primary.
You know, you'd actually be surprised. She has really strong institutional support in Dallas. You know, obviously before she stepped out of the race, almost all of the Dallas delegation, save for a couple of individuals, endorsed her. You know, that's a district where I think folks are not really, traditional voters are not necessarily ready to turn over the keys to someone like Johnson, who is very young, who's, you know, got three Ivy League educations under his belt. He was born and raised in the district, but that is a really interesting dynamic in that district.
So they'd rather have the ethics cloud than Poindexter, basically.
But there's no chance that she would be able to serve even if she were elected in the primary, right?
No, I mean, it's a term of her plea deal is that she can no longer run for elected office ever anywhere.
So Ben, what is this? I mean, how could the district rally behind somebody who has been not only charged with or accused of, but has acknowledged? Maybe I'm just too idealistic about the way people vote for elected officials.
You know, Emily and I actually had a conversation about this when we were up for the last GOP debate in Dallas. Reagan's 11th commandment, thou shalt speak no ill of fellow Republicans. Well, it's almost like that's what the Democrats were doing up there. Despite the fact that she was under indictment, they were, by and large, not willing to speak ill of her and actually going out and endorsing her. I consider, though, that the 12th commandment should be, if one of your colleagues is under indictment, that it's not a bad thing if you decide to sit this one out and not endorse at all. And just, you know, they may come out clean on the other side, but I just think it's a little ridiculous that you could have a politician or a group of politicians say, you know what, we're going to stand behind our person no matter what.
Especially since when the Republicans have a candidate who's ethically challenged, it's these very same Democrats who are quickest to say,
yes,
oh, get this person out of office, vote this person down. It ought to be, the 13th rule ought to be what's good for the goose is good for the gander.
Well, and it's interesting because Terry Hodge did not necessarily, you know, there's no Republican running in that race. But for all of these other Dallas lawmakers who were really quick to endorse Terry, you know, as an incumbent, a lot of them face Republicans in their races. And so, you know, I was talking to Jonathan Neerman, the Dallas County Republican Party chairman up there, and he said, you know, basically, we can't wait to use this against these Dallas Democrats saying, you know, what a great message that is for an ad.
Right.
So-and-so endorsed, you know, Terry Hodge.
Maybe they could now quickly distance themselves from Hodge just to say, well, you know, when she was just accused, we gave her the benefit of the doubt. But now that she's acknowledged it, we think it's an outrage. If they don't do that, it does seem like they're handing the Republicans an opportunity.
Yeah, and I fully expect them to make that quick pivot right away.
Well, I've made some early calls this morning, and nobody was jumping up quickly to say, yes, we've already decided I'm endorsing Eric Johnson. But I expect by the...
Is there an issue with Johnson that we're not aware of? I'm sure you've been reporting on this district's story, so you maybe know. You know, the guy's a Harvard graduate. He's, you know, three Ivy League degrees. He's a young guy, but he's raised a bunch of money.
Right.
He seems to be a plausible candidate. He doesn't have, you know, curious lumps or anything, you know, that would cause people not to vote for him. What's the deal that there's not this rush to get behind him?
I think a lot of folks think he's an exceptional candidate, but, you know, the traditional voters you have in that district are a lot of moms, a lot of grandmothers, people who feel sort of a personal connection with Terry Hodge. You know, she's made her pet issue is, you know, is improving prison conditions. And to a lot of folks in that district who unfortunately have sons who fall into that category, right. You know, she's been a real boon.
Ironically, she may benefit from her own work now.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Serious irony there.
And we have to remember that she was a very well-known and effective Democratic activist before she was elected, too. So, I mean, she's been in that community
big time
for a long
block
time.
Block walker, union organizer.
Yeah. Right.
She's got a history, and she's been reelected, you know, what, 6 times. So.
Well, I think loyalty is great. I think blind loyalty is crazy.
Right. Mm-hmm.
While we're on the topic of the Texas legislature, we had Susan Combs as our guest for Trib Live this week. Evan, talk to us a little bit about what she said about our budget quagmire.
Yeah, you know, the comptroller is an interesting person. She's very atypical, I think, among statewide elected officials in that she's more candid probably than her handlers would like her to be. And at the same time, she's unbelievably not candid. You know, she comes across as very open and warm and funny, and she does funny voices. And she's just not this boring kind of rote person. She's kind of got a particular personality that I think is very endearing to people when you interview. And even if you're a journalist interviewing her, as I've done over the years, many of us have done over the years, it can be frustrating when you ask the same question over and over and they don't give you an answer. But with her, somehow the medicine goes down more easily. She makes it somehow more enjoyable. I thought she actually did reveal some stuff today that we maybe thought we knew but didn't know. For one thing, she acknowledged that, as has been reported by Robert Garrett of the Dallas News and others, that the sales tax collections for the first 4 months of the biennium are significantly off from where they were supposed to be, maybe as much as $1 billion down. She actually said as well, which I thought was really interesting in light of Joe Strauss's a place in that same hot seat a couple weeks ago, at least. Strauss said that he and the lieutenant governor and the governor had signed a letter asking for 5% cuts to state agencies, and he estimated that that might bring in as much as $1 billion a year for the biennium, so $2 billion to take off of the structural deficit that they're anticipating. And the comptroller was actually pretty adamant in saying that she really thought it was going to actually be less than that, that the cuts might amount to only as much as $500 million, so only $1 billion over the biennium, which is another $1 billion that would be in the hole. Now, she was willing to put her faith in the State Board of Education's management of the permanent school fund, and assume that perhaps as much as $1 billion might be thrown the state's way out of the PSF, the way that the SBOE has managed it. We wrote a story this week questioning the competence of the state board in managing the permanent school fund. We may differ with the comptroller on that question,
maybe.
But her point of view on that, in any case, was that there was probably somewhere between $9 billion and $10, $11, $12, $13 that was going to have to be found after the state agency cuts, and the rainy day fund was a target. Right. She didn't suggest that we should take the money entirely from the rainy day fund, maybe take half the rainy day fund, a portion of it. But, you know, you run into this thing where the elected officials of the state, regardless of party, don't want to acknowledge that it's a math problem. Honestly, you can only get a certain amount from state agency cuts. You can only get a certain amount from tricks with the budget, like let's get more money out of the PSF that we didn't anticipate. They're not willing to consider new sources of revenue that involve taxes. Although they are willing, I thought it was also great that she said this morning, we might look at recategorizing people who get exemptions now. So if you don't get an exemption, or if you get an exemption, then we might take your exemption away, but we don't consider that a tax increase. Or if you have an exemption and we tweak it so you now have to pay more, you get less of an exemption, we don't consider that a tax increase. I looked at Bill Hammond of the Texas Association of Business and Talmadge Heflin, the former House member who's now at the Public Policy Foundation, and when Susan Combs said essentially, I don't consider that a tax increase, you could just see on their faces they were not buying it.
Well, it works the other way, though. I mean, Governor Perry has been campaigning saying that they cut the business tax. They really just changed the exemption. So if you can use it to brag about cutting a tax, changing exemptions can also say it the other way and say it's raising a tax.
Right,
too.
And so, what she wants to say is it's not raising a tax. It's a semantic distinction. I asked her about, as I described her, Governor Medina's plan to possibly increase the sales tax as one potential source of revenue. And, you know, this is where the comptroller was a little evasive in terms of not wanting to say I'm for this or against that. This was the point at which she fell back on, I don't make the decision. That's an issue for the legislature.
Now, did she say specifically that she thought 5% was too high, the cuts?
Well, she didn't actually say 5% was too high. She said that she thought that the amount of money that would be got, that the state would get back from the 5% state agency cuts was not as much as they had been saying previously, where the speaker and the governor, lieutenant governor, said they thought it would amount to $1 billion a year across all the state agencies. She said she thought it might even be as little as half of that amount. I asked her if we should consider increasing the cuts to, rather than 5%, maybe to 10 or to 15 or to 20%, which would obviously be really harsh, draconian cuts. And, she said that might be something that they have to look at 6 months or 8 months down the road, depending upon the situation. Perhaps not as much as that, 20% is a lot, but she might have to go back. She said they might have to go back and ask for another 5% or something. And there are certainly people, Dan Patrick, among others, at least you'll remember when Dan Patrick was here. Dan Patrick's position was, whoa, we should cut the budget before we do anything else, and we should look at perhaps as much as a 10% cut off the top. So there are going to be some arguments about whether the cuts are sufficient.
I think it's going to be interesting to see the agencies, once you get past the 5%, seeing the agencies battle over, you need to hold the line at us at 5%, but, Agency X over here, I bet they could get 15% cut, and they'd be just fine.
Right. I know HHSC and those agencies are getting together next week to start talking about, they're set on the 5% number, and so they're trying to find ways. But I know if it creeps much higher than that, they're going to yelp.
And even the 5% number is being met with a lot of resistance. Bill Powers got an institutional pie in the face last night in a meeting that we reported on today on the Tribune. Brian Tevenot was at the meeting last night that the president of UT Austin had with very unhappy people over the closing of the Cactus Cafe. Now, it's sort of standard operating procedure in Austin to have not been to the Cactus Cafe in 4 years, but to complain loudly about the fact that it's closing. And so you have to discount a certain amount of this anger as just the usual velvet prison whining that happens in Austin anytime a music institution closes.
Version of Liberty Lunch.
Right. People just get like super nostalgic for something they haven't been to in a long time. On the other hand, the president is finding that, even 5% cut at the University of Texas, which after all is a state agency, right?
That
there's a whole lot of pushback on specific decisions being made. And I think if they go back to these guys and they say, now you got to cut another 5%.
And at what point are you really down to the bone? There's no meat left to cut anymore, especially with these agencies that have already, as a result of the 2003 cuts, been faced with, scandal, as we saw in TYC, or, CPS not being able to meet the needs of children.
Yeah, or health agencies that are going to face a huge, increase in Medicaid payments, Medicare, Medicaid payments through this, some incarnation of this Washington healthcare bill,
And what happens to the CHIP program this time around, which got, over a third of the kids were chopped off of the CHIP program in 2003.
The interesting thing is a lot of state agencies would tell you that even without the 5% cut, they don't have enough money.
Right.
It's a low-tax, low-service state. You get what you pay for. We're already paying guards in the criminal justice system about $1.30 a year to do their jobs. There are a lot of people who work as civil servants in this state, basically people who are on the state employee dole. And I would encourage people to go to our state employee database to see just how low those salaries are. The fact is, there are people who are not being paid sufficiently now, and if the cuts begin to affect even that low level of pay or those low level of services, I think you're going to have a lot more screaming.
We've already been having all that trouble recruiting DPS officers, for instance, which is a great story, for us potentially down the road.
I just think the idea that this state will not consider the possibility that all of our options have kind of come and gone, and that we have to look for new sources of revenue. It's remarkable to me that the legislature, which does not want to be on the record supporting a tax increase, would not at least kick the can down the road and say, just as has happened in other states recently, Oregon, we talked about Ben last week on the podcast, and Elise, put it in the hands of the voters. If the voters of the state don't want a tax increase to offset, and they would rather have cuts of state agencies, let's let the voters decide. Pass a deal in the legislature. There's a referendum, statewide referendum on this. Let them decide.
They'll choose casinos.
Well, that's interesting. We didn't talk about gaming with the comptroller today, but that actually could come back up as we talked about last week.
But it wouldn't surprise me if they didn't choose. State of Alabama, about 6 years ago or so, when Governor Riley, who was, before he became governor, voted the most conservative member of Congress, became the governor of Texas, of Alabama then, he put out a $1 billion tax and spend package that he said the state needed to pass, or there would be, third cuts to some agencies, something really horrible, third cut to the school budget, all this stuff. It included a bunch of different taxes. It also included new, new library facilities as part of it, showing where the money would be spent, not just what would be raised. Went across the state and said, look, it is the Christian thing to do to vote for this. And it went down 2-1.
So despite his best efforts, they still wouldn't vote for it.
Yes, and he had all the conservative credentials to say, look, we have done everything. This is our last option. It needs to be passed. Went down 2-1. So, I mean, Texas and Alabama are both similar red states. I mean, I think that rural Texas especially is quite similar to pretty much the whole state of Alabama.
And honestly, if the voters of this state, as I suspect they would do in a referendum, voted down a proposed tax increase, then ultimately the legislature has no fear that there's going to be popular revolt when they cut state agencies.
But right? I don't think they have that fear now. I mean, I think they already are working under the assumption that voters do not support any new taxes. So, you know, we'll up the fees here and there as they did in 2003. Right. You know, tuition is obviously still climbing and deal with it that way.
You know, you two are about to get married, Elise and Emily. I wonder if you were willing to pay $6 to the Justice of the Peace instead of $2 if it would bother you to have to file that paperwork to get your marriage license. And if there were enough of you out there, that's going to be meaningful. I mean, the idea of a fee increase is great in theory, but as a practical matter, how much money is it actually going to bring in?
Yeah, good question. Well, Ben and I's topic this week is a preview of the gubernatorial debate showdown between the Democratic candidates, Farrukh Shami and Bill White, which I'm really excited about because Farrukh Shami's going to debate. I mean, that was the first response.
This sounds like an episode of Twin Peaks, these two together up on stage. One of them carries a log. I'm definitely going to be excited.
I'm excited either way.
I think it's really going to be interesting. I mean, you know, I think much has been made from the stump interrupted of some of Farrukh Shami's speech qualities. The way he delivers his, you know, his stump speeches have been kind of all over the place a little bit. I mean, he doesn't do it, no teleprompters, no script. He just kind of riffs. And the problem is that it sounds like he's just riffing sometimes. And it's going to be really interesting to see how focused I think he can be. It's going to be interesting to see if Bill White can keep his answers under 15 minutes. And it's going to be interesting to see if Farrukh Shami can keep his answers focused.
Well, his speech is very halting. It's actually not even speaking. It's really yelling. You know, when you're in front of him, he's just screaming at you. And I just wonder, and the more nervous he gets, the worse he gets. His volume just increases. And so I wonder, as he's being tested on issues that he's supposed to have knowledge of over the state, I mean, they're taking this, KERA, which is sponsoring the debate, is taking this seriously, ostensibly going
as they
to
should.
Ask, right, and ostensibly going to ask a lot of tough questions about, you know, issues like the budget. And so...
Well, I'm worried for him on the easy questions. Mr. Shami, who's the comptroller? Silence. I mean, didn't this happen to Statesman last week? Didn't they ask him a bunch of questions about who certain people were, and he didn't even know that? I mean, I'd be worried for him not on the hard ones, on the easy ones.
Yeah, that's a good point. And another tactical question is how Bill White deals with it. I mean, does he engage at all, or does he kind of just speak straight through Farrukh Shami being on stage?
Right. I mean, does he have anything to gain by attacking Shami's answers, or should he just keep the blinders on and answer the questions to the best of his ability and move on?
Do y'all know, does Shami have any experience in this kind of setting? I mean, obviously we've seen him in stump speeches. You know, have we seen him at all in a Q&A type of setting?
Even the press conferences that I've been to, and at least I think you've been to a couple as well, even there it's he doesn't exactly answer the questions as focused as some reporters would like. And
the answer is jobs, more jobs.
Yes. And he, you know, I mean, quite frankly, the one he had in Austin, it sounded like he had a couple of advocacy groups in the crowd asking questions that were kind of softballs. And I'm not even sure that he answered those as best as possible.
I want to identify the skunk in the room here, which is that another interesting aspect of this debate will be to see how Shami's ethnicity after the fact is viewed by people who watch the debate and have really engaging in this primary for the first time, and whether there's some blowback on a guy who is clearly not from here. You know, the fact is, we had already this week in Anderson County, somebody say, you know, there's no way that anybody in this state's going to vote for a guy named Farrukh Shami or who sounds like that. Of course, it's horribly racist, ethnicist, to make assumptions about you know, the worth of a candidate on the basis of how he speaks or how he looks or what his name is. On the other hand, we have to acknowledge as well that, goodness knows, African Americans in the Democratic Party have had hard times in parts of Texas getting treated as seriously as they might have been as candidates. Ron Kirk found this in 2002. Tony Sanchez, Barack Hussein Obama's name is being, all three of those names are being thrown around in Waco by the fellow running against Kip Averett. The reality is that Mr. Shami's ethnicity could be more of a factor because he will now be on camera before more people than he has been so far. It's unfair to him, but I think that that's something that we're going to have to keep an eye out for. Ben, to your question, Bill White just does not look left and does not look right. He answers the question. And that's it. I don't think he engages Shami really very much at all because he has nothing to gain and everything to lose.
Well, I think, getting back to Shami real quickly, I think that maybe that should be a good debate question for him. Ross and I had a chance to sit down with Mr. Shami in December and ask that question. You know, is it what is your background? How hard is your background going to be to overcome for this race? He answered very well, you know, talked about his own personal story of, I mean, you know, coming to America with nothing, and now he's a millionaire. You know, he might be able to make a connection there, but he's going to have to give that same kind of focused, sincere answer that he gave when, you know, it was three reporters and the candidate, you know, in a closed room.
And I just don't think he could go lower than he is. I mean, I don't know anybody who believes, anybody who's paying attention who believes that Shami is anywhere above maybe the low double digits.
Has there even been a poll at this point with White versus Shami? Of course, the Texas Tribune poll will have that question in it, and the results of that will be out at some point between now and March 2nd.
You know,
anything away.
Hey, speaking of polls, though, Bill White can't even beat Deborah Medina. Is that the latest poll now?
Rasmussen poll.
Came out with a poll today showing
how red is Texas?
That's right.
That red. Right? That red is the answer. Well, you know, Democrats, we know the Democrats are like Sisyphus pushing that rock up the hill. I mean, we just know that it was that way in 06. It's that way now. The Democrats who say that White is competitive or have a point in the sense that White is more competitive than other people. But, you know, White versus Medina, which is not going to happen. But that would be interesting, wouldn't it?
I think that that poll actually hurts Senator Hutchison more than the poll that showed she was down 44-29.
Because
if you have an argument about Medina, if you're Perry Hutchison and your argument is, you know, a vote for her is a waste because she can't win in November.
Right, if she's the nominee, you know Bill White's going to win.
Yeah, you know Bill White's going to win if she's the nominee. Well, now that's no longer, according to at least one poll, the case.
Imagine
if
you're margin on that. Medina White.
It was, oh shoot.
Quiz time.
Oh, sorry.
It was like six or seven points. It wasn't It was like six or seven points.
Imagine if you're the White campaign and you wake up this morning to find that there's a poll that has Medina beating you in November. You go, oh God.
And they will point out, though, that these Republicans have been all over the place and getting all the attention, and he has not, and had not been on statewide TV yet. So
it's interesting that we haven't actually talked about that poll from yesterday today on the podcast. We might want to say just a word about that,
which is,
you know, 44-29-16, Perry Hutchison Medina. If you had told any of us, I suspect, even as recently as 2 months ago, that with only about a month out from the primary, that would be the Rasmussen poll, assuming that it's accurate. I'm not surprised by anything. I'm surprised by those numbers. I'm surprised by Hutchison's number. I'm surprised by Medina's number.
Right, Medina crept up, what, like 6 or 8%?
She's actually up 12 points from the fall, I think, when she was first included in the polls. And I'll say, I asked this of Susan Combs today. You know, she thought it was not a problem, but I'm not so sure. The fact is, Rick Perry's been governor for almost 10 years, and he still could not crack 50% in a reelect number in a poll a month out from the primary. And I just think that's interesting. If it ends up in as we talked about Ben last week, if he ends up in a runoff in April, having not been able to get to 50% reelect, that is a dangerous place for him to be.
It absolutely can be. I've seen too many of those where even the person with the, you know, one vote away from getting 50% just loses every single supporter from the other side. The Medina poll was 44% Medina, 38% Bill White.
Yeah, so a nice
Thank you, iPhone.
That's right.
All right. If you have any questions or comments for the podcasters, you can email podcasts@texastribune.org. But for now, for Evan, Ben, and Emily, I'm Elise. Thank you for listening.